Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. It is me, Alina, and I'm flying solo today. I have with me today Susan Stewart, who is a historian who specialises in the culture history and impact of cosmetics throughout history. Her first book was Painted Faces, A Colourful History of Cosmetics, and she's here today to talk to us about her new book, Common and Uncommon Scents, A Social History of Perfume. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited. We were just talking now that your book actually was delayed because of COVID.
Yes, it was. It kind of hit the publishers at the wrong moment when things were quite difficult. So it has been somewhat delayed. I rushed to finish it, and then COVID hit, and inevitably, the publishers had quite a backlog to catch up with when that.
It's out now.
It's out on the 15th of November.
So we have not long for this book to come out, for everybody to grab themselves a copy and read it.
I hope so. It's got a fantastic front cover, so I hope that will appeal.
I've got to say, I am a massive, huge fan of perfume. And every time I walk through the airport, so duty free, that's the word I was looking for. Every time I walk through duty free, I have to buy myself a new perfume. So my collection is just growing and growing and growing endlessly.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much I actually personally use it. I do use it, but the book is really about how people used it in the past, obviously, and the variety of ways in which they used it, which was extensive.
Well, let's talk about that, because you mention in your book that the first use of scent can be found all the way back to the Neolithic period, ancient Mesopotamia and Crete. So what sort of things were they used for, and what were they using for scents?
Well, the Neolithic period, obviously, evidence is fairly scanty. We've got no writing, and the materials that were being used were organic and therefore decayed. So we're really sort of shooting in the dark a wee bit with that. But there seems to be a possibility, archaeologists think, that maybe incense, because that's one of the earliest uses of perfume, was burning scent. So possibly for purification purposes, maybe even birth practices. They have found something which looks like a mattress in South Africa, which was stuffed with aromatic herbs and grasses, which may or may not have been a defence against fleas, because again, perfume, as we associate it with, you know, body perfume, with adornment, with looking, smelling pleasant, or even certainly smelling pleasant anyway, there were so many other uses in the past that things were used for. So it's quite possible that, you know, a mattress like that, the content of it was in fact to defend against insects and bugs and things. There's also some pots from Syria which have been found to contain cedarwood, juniper, pine resin, for example. We can work that out now using techniques that we have that don't damage the vessel, but we can scoop out what's inside, or take a residue from the inside using something, I think it's called gas spectrometry. So that has been analysed. Mesopotamian and Minoan civilization, that's much. There's much more evidence, because obviously we've got writing. Perfumes crop up all over the place, particularly on these accounts on the cuneiform tablets, because they're buying in lots of scent materials to make perfumes. They're found evidence for their use is found in sort of funerary settings, where the incense in perfume is burnt as an incense, and in domestic settings as well, we see incense burners shown on wall paintings, depicted on wall paintings. The idea was that this smoke was a means of communicating with the gods. So it was a sort of two-way street. The people communicated with their gods through this smoke. Most of it would have been gum resins or wood bark. So things like cedarwood or frankincense or myrrh. They would also have maybe used roses and some flower scents as well, and possibly even imported things like cinnamon. Because although things often came from far away and people didn't really know where they came from, but people like the Phoenicians were ardent traders, so they would be bringing stuff into, maybe not on a regular basis, but they would be bringing stuff into the Mediterranean. They also perfumed their wine. And one thing that the Minoans were, we know they were particularly keen on, was saffron. And there are lots of illustrations in the palaces of people gathering saffron. Saffron doesn't really smell very much, but when it's crushed, it does.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would never have thought that, because, you know, people cook with saffron.
Yes.
I never thought that you would actually crush it and burn it.
Yeah, it doesn't smell like it. I don't think it's got a particularly strong smell, unlike some of the other things that they would have been using. But they seem to have harvested that, the Minoans anyway, to quite a great extent. They would have perfumed their wine maybe with rose water. The perfumes were a symbol of power as well. A lot of the production of perfumes in the Minoan civilization, anyway, happened inside the royal palaces. Some of it might have been sent out for finishing to villages in the local area, but a lot of it was centered around the king. Perfume equal power. It's almost like associating nice smells with gods, so important people, wealth. These were expensive ingredients as well. So there was a great deal of value in scent, in owning scent and having containers with scent in them. So yeah, that's there's lots of evidence at various of the palaces, Palace of Nestor in the Greek Peloponnese and various other ones where there are vats and other perfume making equipment. Does that answer your question?
No, it does. I mean, I was thinking when you said incense, for example, myrrh, the first thing that came to mind for me at biblical times, because we all know the story of when Jesus was born and three kings came and they bought gold, myrrh, and I forgot what the other thing is now. My mind's gone completely blank.
Frankincense,
that was it. So, and that's all the thing that goes through our mind is at the biblical times, they're bringing something expensive to baby Jesus.
Yes, but there are these things are also supposed to prefigure his death and all sorts of other things as well. The myrrh, I think, because it was apparently, I'm not that well up on the sort of biblical allusion, but yes, these things have been identified as prefiguring parts of his life as well. But yeah, they were valued, and they're still expensive today. Saffron's expensive if you're going to cook with it, and because you only get a tiny little drop. Frankincense and myrrh both fairly costly if you're going to buy in terms of buying an essential oil or whatever. So yeah, these things were of great value then. And I suppose the other reason they were of value is, which I probably haven't mentioned and should have mentioned, is that they could be applied as a medicine. So, and they didn't have much else. So, you know, hence the value as well.
That's very interesting, because talking about medicines, kind of in a way you link medicine with religion, especially in ancient cultures. So can you tell us how scents and perfumes featured in religion of ancient civilizations, and how is it depicted? How did it impact their cultures? But before I actually finish this question, I just want to add something, because if I'm not mistaken, the ancient Egyptians also used scents to cover the body. Am I right in that?
Yes, I mean, in earliest times they would still have used it as a body perfume, but part of that would have been to present themselves as being healthy, to smell nice. And as a means of cleaning themselves and smelling clean. And
The only, sorry, just to interrupt, is because this was used as a religious purpose, really, at the end of the day, of mummifying a body and then kind of, I guess, cleansing it is through scents.
preserving it as well. Yeah, and the mummification process does involve a lot of scent and stuffing the body with various parts of the body with different sorts of perfume. This was about preserving the body and preparing it for an afterlife where that body would be part of that afterlife. So yeah, it was a long and time-consuming process, which obviously rich people, the pharaohs, etc., all went through. So yeah, and it was also very much part linked with the religion. I mean, the ancient Egyptians have got perfume recipes, had perfumes recipes, written on the walls of some of their temples, on the innermost bits of the temples, where that information was important to the priests who ran the temple, but wasn't on public view, perhaps to the wider population. But they would have been very familiar with the smells surrounding the temple, but they wouldn't necessarily have known how they were put together. And there are lots of different recipes, for instance, for the perfume kiffi, which is in some descriptions has about 16 ingredients, and in other recipes it has about 50. So these were complex recipes, known only to those who needed to know them.
I've got to say, wow, that's just incredible. Do you know if anybody's ever recreated the recipes?
There's been a few attempts, yes.
Successful?
There's been one or two exhibitions. I think in Greece, in Athens, there was one where they tried to recreate some of the scents. It's difficult to, even if we recreate the scent, we can't really get to how the people of the time would have reacted to the scent, or how it mixed with the other smells that were round about in the world that they lived in.
That's really interesting. I find that we can still try, at least try and recreate
Yeah.
it, but we can't recreate the conditions, but we can recreate the product, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But the thought behind it is, or the feelings about it, that particularly, I suppose, is important when you come to sort of city living, where you've got, food being sold, you've got an incense being burnt, you've got animals, you've got all sorts of things which is mixed together. So yeah, their idea of what smelt bad or smelt good varies a bit from what we might think. I mean, some of these scents that they're using, things like cedar wood, etc., we would probably still use. I'm not sure how much we would fancy pine resin, rather other than as a cough treatment, or we wouldn't see it as a something to wear as a to go out for an evening, for instance.
Oh, I don't know. I'm one of these people that actually burns pine resin in their home.
Oh well, right, okay. But
I'm
that would be okay, but to put it on yourself, I don't know. I mean, everybody's, that's the other thing, it's very subjective. Everybody's idea of what smells nice and what they like and what they don't like varies. So it's another factor to throw in the mix.
could just smell like a freshly car made car, one of those car air fresheners, that's the word I was looking for. Just walk around smelling like a car air freshener, because that's a pine smell.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe you can get some very posh cars that actually have a range of smells, and you press the button and you can choose one.
Wow, I
So I
need a car like
believe.
that.
So I believe. I'm not quite sure on that one, but it's one of these developments of technology which happens by the time we get to the 21st century, as opposed to being in Neolithic times.
Oh, wow. I mean, we're talking about a time period. I'd love to talk about ancient civilization, especially for the next 25 minutes, but we've got a long time period to head through. So let's kick off and move to the early Middle Ages, because early Middle Ages, you get the church, and you would think that it would be a period of stagnation for the use of perfumes because of the strict nature of the church, but it's not quite true, is it?
No, it's initially there was some dislike of perfumes as far as the church was concerned. I mean, you've got the ascetics and people who sort of rebelled against anything that was might be associated with something pleasant or cleanliness or whatever. But these people were possibly in the minority. The church very quickly adopted perfume because it became very much part of sense of part of their worship. So there were burning incense again in a honor of the god of the god. Okay, the herbs and flowers still remained, had a medicinal value, so they couldn't sort of chuck them out altogether. They still had a very important function out with the church to fulfill. So, and the saints themselves, they were believed to smell good, and fragrance was an indication of their presence. So what's called the odor of sanctity. So bottles of perfumed water were sold to pilgrims as as healing products, which they claimed were a you know it was the scent exuded by the saint. And then of course you've got the thurible, which the swaying censer, which the church still uses. And if you were a pilgrim traveling a long distance to one of the sites of pilgrimage, then this censer, and you can imagine, you know, all these sort of sweaty pilgrims turning up, you know, the smell of the censer would have sort of counteracted that a bit. And also it's very calming and soothing, the motion and the smell of the frankincense, etc. So yeah, they quickly adopted saint as something that was part of their worship.
So moving on from the Middle Ages, we're moving on to the further on from the Middle Ages time period. You open up, for example, trade routes. You've got India, you've got Portugal, you've got the Americas. That must have had a huge effect on the European sensing.
Now, I'm not sure that it did really. The trade routes had always been there. They could be pretty fairly unreliable in the ancient in world. It was, you know, a hit or a miss whether you got what you would have liked to have got. And there was an inconsistency in the supply, if you like. But there was a lot of materials coming from places from very far away into Europe without the people living in Europe in the ancient world really knowing where these things had come from, which added to the mystique. So you were actually caravans from Arabia. There was material from China even coming into Europe. And of course that boosted the price because all sorts of ideas grew up about where these materials had come from, and you know some fantastic ideas about the phoenix nest or wherever, you know, that they were somehow magical that they'd turned up. So in the Americas, yes, was the discovery of tobacco, of course, which doesn't seem like a particularly exciting perfume ingredient, but it was, and very popular at the beginning of the 20th century. In some sense. So yeah, and then there was the discovery of, well, various discoveries by Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama and people like that, who did open up the trade routes, certainly. Spain was still very much to the centre, and so was Venice as a trading city, and there was a lot of cachet that in the sense of Italian stuff coming from Italy, perfumes coming from Italy and also from Spain, scented gloves given to Elizabeth the First, that sort of thing.
Did you just say scented gloves given to Elizabeth the First?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, scented gloves were very much the end thing, because hands were often the first point of contact with your betrothed, if you like. Perhaps you've never, you know, it's not exactly a sort of arranged marriage, I suppose. So hands were really important as a first point of contact. So it was important to keep them white and clean and soft. So gloves smeared in the inside with scent, and with a sort of scented oil, were the thing to do. Some people even slept with them on to keep their hands and looking good. So yeah, scented gloves were, any lady of standing would have worn gloves.
I like that idea. I think we should bring that back, scented gloves. Because you've got the mass unwashed on public transport. That might make a bit of a difference.
Well, yes. Well, that's true. That is, I suppose, true. But, scented gloves were definitely... And coming from places like Spain or Portugal, these were much valued.
So perfumes and scents, they played quite an important role, because you've mentioned this very briefly at the beginning of our chat, that they played an important role in medicine.
Yes.
And, for example, fighting the plague, didn't they?
Yeah. Fighting the plague, well, basically they didn't have much else, really, but things like rue or rosemary or cloves, cinnamon and various other aromatics were considered to be effective against the plague. Of course, nothing much really was, but the plague doctor, the image of the plague doctor with his beaked nose, which people hopefully have maybe seen, with his hat and his long cloak completely covered, the nose would have been stuffed with aromatic plants to try and protect him from catching the plague if he was obviously going to be in contact with it, trying to treat it. It must have been quite a frightening experience to see him really approaching with his hooked nose and his long cloak. They were supposed to, they believed that bad smells in the air, miasma, spread germs. So to put pleasant smells into the air was thought to counteract the plague. So women might walk around with a nosegay and hold that close to their nose to try and prevent succumbing to the plague. And one of the first perfumes, called Queen of Hungary Water, which is the first perfume really similar to what we would buy nowadays, in that it's a liquid, alcohol-based liquid. In the past, perfumes could be solid, semi-solid or liquid, but they were quite likely, they were not alcohol-based, they were oil-based, olive oil or whatever. So the Queen of Hungary's water was alcohol-based, and its main purpose originally was as a plague water, not necessarily as we would associate wearing perfume to, as a matter of adornment.
So I'm interested, because I'm hopefully that scents do become more readily available, but is this possible by the 18th century?
Yes, but buying scents, buying it already manufactured.
Yeah, merchants were starting to bring them over more.
Yeah, the there were a lot of different outlets, a lot of different places you could buy perfume. So you've got everything from peddlers selling perfumes at doors to the beginnings of the perfume houses. And you could even buy them in places we might not think of, like hat shops or libraries. So there was
libraries. Sorry. Yeah.
I know. There was a vast range of them, but homemade was still practiced because some of the large country houses were, which had large gardens, they had the supplies and the servants of the skill to do, to produce some perfume. Obviously, the sort of standard of it or the strength of it varied from house to house. The incentive to make your own was still there because of the cost, quite often, of scent, of something that had a cachet that some wealthy lady or wealthy gentleman might want to put on their handkerchief or on themselves or on wherever. But yeah, they were still pricey. So, and also there was lots of books out there to explain how to make perfume. So there was no shortage of recipes available, sometimes in cookery books, at the back of cookery books, or in medical manuals, because they were obviously still being used as, everything to, from gynecological problems or to get rid of spots or hair loss or anything really that you would find these ingredients, or maybe sort of like a herbal bath or for rheumatism, things like that.
Slowly and surely, you come to the Victorian age, and fashion must have changed this.
Perfumes became a bit more gender-based, because in the past they had been, you know, pretty much men and women, and anything went for either men or women. And, of course, the purposes of perfume, like the medicine side of things and all that, didn't discriminate between men and women. The Victorians didn't discriminate to any great degree, but it was sort of thought that maybe florals for women, like roses and violets and lavender, whereas more aromatic things like cedar wood were more suited for men. There was a class distinction as well, because you could buy lavender from a street corner seller, but then if you had any money, you would be wanting to go to one of the great perfume houses. There was also novelties as well, like squirting finger rings and sort of as fountains in shops, perfume fountains, and ladies would dip their handkerchiefs in the fountains. That was in the sort of early, very early department store kind of idea.
That's very good. That's crazy. I mean, not that it's crazy. I don't mean crazy in that sort of sense, but you would have a perfume fountain and ladies would just come and dip their hand. I just find that just unimaginable.
Well, I mean, the ancient Romans had perfume fountains as well. But so it's, a lot of these things are not necessary. They have some basis in the past, if you like. The shopping, the idea of shopping Victorian times as well was a... there was a sort of luxury end shopping of which perfume was part of. The perfume houses, which began to be set up in France and also some in America and some in Britain.
You just mentioned that, perfume houses. Let's stick with this. Let's delve a little bit more deeper into this, because they exist today, obviously.
Yeah.
Did this affect the perfume culture?
Well, there was an element of perfume culture became very exclusive. So you've got Guerlain, Creed, Piessen, Lubin, Rimmel, to name but a few of the perfume houses. And these were frequented by the rich and famous, and who lent their cachet or their name to the, often to the brands. Sometimes these perfume companies made scents that were tailored specifically to one individual. The crowned heads of Europe, they sort of gave their backing to these places and were well-known customers. And the fact that it's a sort of early advertising, if you like. So these companies did well on the back of some of their clientele, if you like. So anybody with money would want to favour one of these perfume houses. Queen Victoria Napoleon III and some of the Russian royals favoured Gourlane, for instance. And the House of Gourlane made signature saints for them. These were symbols of wealth and status. So, but this at the same time, it sort of other outlets appeared. So there were cheaper outlets like perfume bazaars and the department stores, which brought this new way of shopping in. I suppose you could try and not buy if you could dip your handkerchief in the fountain, you know. No doubt you would have to be turned up looking as if you had some money in order to get through the door. But it was a very the salons, the Gourlane's salon or Creed's salon was very exotic, very beautifully decorated with one nice furniture, lots of plants. It was somewhere that was very exclusive to visit. There were quite a number of these places, and some of them are still going today.
By the way, I'm on the Gourlane website right now, trying to have a look if they have the scent that you just mentioned, the personal scent for Queen Victoria. I mean, I can't seem to find it. But do you think they actually replicated this for mainstream use in the modern times?
I don't think so. I think one of the Russian nobles had a scent that I can't remember if it was Gourlane or not that he went to, but it was specially commissioned for him, and it was sold only to him until his death. I think they then produced a sort of version of it after that. But yeah, these things would not have been sort of distributed to anybody else.
I mean, that's a shame. I think right now that would make such a great market for this historical perfume. And people would probably, I would go crazy. I would buy Queen Victoria's perfume just to have it on my shelf. I might not like it. You never know. As you said, you know, we're all partial to our own scents, but I would have it as a novelty.
Yeah, I mean, the bottles themselves were certainly collectible and certainly were very expensive. The coin, you know, it was important way back in the ancient world to produce a vessel which expressed the value of the content inside. So the bottles that were being produced by these people were being produced or made by but when you get to the beginning of the 20th century, they're being made by Baccarat and Lalique and people who are making glass vessels for a tableware and all sorts of other things. But these are a antique value in their own right.
Which kind of brings us nicely into the 20th century, because we've seen a massive proliferation of scents into our everyday lives. We've just had that conversation, literally, that you know, I use perfume all the time. But how has this been achieved over the last 100 years?
Well, advertising, of course, became a huge thing. Celebrity advertising or... maybe, you know, by the sort of 60s, you're getting sort of people from the film industry, etc., advertising scent. But earlier on, it's the society ladies. Magazines as well, women's magazines. There's a proliferation of women's magazines. So it's gone from, you know, quite small-time advertising to quite major opportunities to promote your scent. Cheaper production and technology as well. So one thing I don't think we mentioned, that from the 19th century onwards, you're getting synthetics being used, so that replicate the smell of the natural product, but are an awful lot cheaper to and quicker to work with than the plant material, because the plant material, you often needed a vast amount of the raw product to produce the perfume. So the technology developed to produce these synthetics was a whole lot cheaper and quicker. We've gone back to the past as well, though, in the 20th century, because people are very keen on the idea of aromatherapy. So we're going right back to the idea of the health benefits of the rose oil or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, we haven't lost that idea. We haven't lost the religion idea either, because it's still there within the Catholic Church anyway. So some of these ideas have proved to be, they've either stood the test of time or they've proved that there is actually some merit in it. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't go to your doctor if you've got some sort of ailment and just sort of splash on the rose oil, but at the same time, they are not without some merit. So there is that. The changing role of women as well had an impact to some extent. But the giving of gifts or perfume gifts and big sets with different, a perfume, a powder, everything matching in the 60s, etc., was a popular gift for men to give to women. And women had been given perfume by men way back in Roman times. So it's, that still keeps going. The more department stores, Selfridges opened its perfume department in 1910, I think, and it was a lavish affair. There are early photographs of that. Pyramid selling as well, that was getting to more people. So you've got Avon selling their perfume, now considered a lot of it very vintage looking, but popular, and a younger market as well they were aiming at, sort of young teenage girls with Pretty Peach and things like that. So yeah, men, well, that's coming back in the 21st century, I think, more men wanting perfume and cosmetic products. And then you've got the technology of, it's the car, scenting your car or your clothing, sports clothing. They're able to impregnate trainers and sports socks and things like that with scent to counteract sweat, etc., etc. So yeah, I mean, we've moved away from some of the things, but we've also incorporated other aspects of the use of perfume that have been around since Neolithic times, or at least since the ancient world, when we know for sure, when we've got the writing and we've got an idea of what's a greater idea of what was available.
So before we finish, just out of curiosity, what is your favourite perfume?
Well, I've got one or two. I like Rose by Paul Smith, which isn't particularly expensive, but and I have to confess that I really like a vintage perfume called Sweet Honesty by Avon, which is really not available anymore.
See, that's the worst thing. They make a beautiful perfume and then they just take it out of production.
Yeah. Well, I mean, True Love by Elizabeth Arden, I like that one as well. But what's yours?
Mine, actually, I don't. Many people don't know this company. It's quite an expensive company. A friend once bought me perfume because long story cut short, I used to work in the centre of London, and one of the clients was Le Labo. And I would go into that perfume shop all the time, and I just fell in absolute love with Lise. It's Lise 41. It's like a floral jasmine with lilies. Oh, it's just so beautiful. And my friend one day went in there secretly and bought me a bottle. And I wear it sparingly because it's so expensive, but it is definitely one of my favorites. And everybody will always compliment me when I'm wearing it.
Oh, that's nice. No, that is a thing about you. The only thing about using it sparingly is if it goes off or something awful like that. I mean, throughout history, they've struggled to try and keep preserve perfume. In the ancient world, again, it was dense vessels made of alabaster, etc., that tried to try and keep in the smell, and vessels with tight fitting lids, etc. We're better at that now, of course, and I think probably the synthetics and such like help that, and not the organic materials that go off so quickly. Although a lot of the smaller perfume companies still they want to market something a bit more natural. So
this one's not so natural. Thank God. Thank God, because I think it's so expensive. I can't afford this bottle of perfume so often. But it is. It's very, I love jasmine and I love floral smells. So it's definitely my favourite.
Yeah.
But Susan, listen, remind our listeners the name of your book.
It's called Common and Uncommon Scents, A Social History of Perfume. And it's out on the 15th of November, I think.
Thank you so much for joining us. I love this. It is something that we don't do very often. You know, we usually delve into something military, but the history of perfume and scents has been so interesting and so fascinating that I've loved this. This past hour has been fantastic. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.